Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Ken Pai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So, continuing my series of looking at different immersive stories and experiences at South by Southwest 2025, today's episode is with a piece called Symphony, which is also continuing my section of looking at different embodied interactions and experiences at South by Southwest. So Symphony is essentially like a rhythm game that is using your hands. It's derived and inspired from the process of directing a symphony, but there's a lot of the visual aesthetic that is abstracted out. So it's really trying to get to the mechanics of you moving your hands within the context of the circle and breaking out through the circle. And sometimes you have to trace your hand along these dots. And so you have your hands are out there, and you can either use your hand tracking, and then you are shooting out these different lasers that are then at a distance controlling these interactions of this kind of rhythm game. But you also have the ability to use your controllers. So we talk around some of the trade-offs between the two. But the real interesting thing about this piece is that it's actually produced by a number of University of Southern California, the USC Games program. Had a number of different students that were participating in the process of producing this as part of their school project. So that's where Ingram was coming out of, but also was able to collaborate with a lot of his students that were there as well. And he's just thinking very deeply around not only the game design, but also the interior design and the design of these other virtual spaces. You actually start off in mixed reality, and then if you are doing well in the piece, then it actually goes into more fully immersive VR. So there's a way that they use the transition between mixed reality and virtual reality as a reward mechanic to encourage you to keep on playing. So yeah, lots of different insights from all the different rhythm games that are out there, but also a lot of design decisions and trade-offs that you have to make in the process of iterating whatever you're preferencing. There's lots of different things that you kind of tune your game design. And so we really dig into a lot of the nuances of that game design process for Symphony, which is actually available on the Quest store. They can buy now. You can actually go out and try it out. I'd highly recommend checking it out. It's actually really quite compelling. So that's what we're coming on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Ingram happened on Tuesday, March 11th, 2025 at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
My name is Ingram. I'm the game director for Symphony, also the co-founder of our studio, Tech Toy Studio. So we're very flattered to be here at South by Southwest today and this week, showcasing our first title.
Great. Maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into the space.
Yeah, so I have a pretty interesting background. I actually started as an interior architect. My journey into VR came from literally one experience I had at Chelsea, New York during the early Rift days. Tried a demo, was immediately blown away by the medium, and decided to kind of shift my career towards it. Went to USC for grad school. It was there where I meet a lot of my co-founder there. A lot of our teams are from USC. Had an opportunity for 3 years to just focus academically and experimenting with VR and development. And then after graduation, found a group of misfits who are very into making these immersive experiences, and together we banded and started our studio.
Great. So maybe you could talk about the origins of Symphony. Where did this specific project begin?
So this came from an orchestral performance by the Chicago Orchestra 2 years ago when I was on a very short vacation. Was very mind-blown by the performance. I think it was on Tchaikovsky. I was going home, and I just find myself keep kind of waving my hands around it. And just from that brief moment, I had that feeling of synesthesia almost, like that Kandinsky painting where I'm seeing the notes kind of flying in, they're visualizing in front of me. And I've always wanted to do something that was visually impactful, that was somewhat synesthetic. Never really moved forward with the project because I was missing some sort of context with it. And then as I was waving, it made complete sense if you kind of pair that together. It immediately brought me back to that scene in Disney's Fantasia when Mickey Mouse was kind of daydreaming, waving his hands, and then you see his imagination where he's like controlling the waves in otherworldly spaces. And I realized with the latest headsets, you know, there's a lot of capabilities where you can do that. And what else was interesting about this project in the very beginning was the idea of these other worlds, imaginations, fantastical realms. I think they're quite rewarding, and sometimes I'm more interested in highlighting them through contrast. And I think mixed reality became this very fantastic medium for this, where in the game, for example, you're always starting in reality. So anything you see virtual, these magical realms, as we call it in the game, is essentially a reward of your performance. So I think that just makes it all the more powerful, instead of kind of immediately putting into VR into this isolated environment where you actually feel like you earned it, that it's part of that journey and experience.
Yeah, and maybe you could take a step back and talk a bit more about, when's the first time you encountered virtual reality as a medium and that you knew that you wanted to pursue it?
So I think my first experience is a little cliche. So it was a roller coaster ride. I think it was the Oculus Gear, if I remember correctly.
The Gear VR, yeah.
Yes, the Samsung one. It was just a roller coaster ride, but when I got in, I was just so blown away by the fidelity. Like, I felt the space. And as I said before, I was trained as an interior architect. So in college at Pratt Institute, I was always trained to kind of think and visualize spaces. So immediately, I was very excited by that. The idea that you can create this infinite possibility of these spatial experiences that you get to go through that wouldn't be possible in reality, frankly. The experience was a simple roller coaster ride, I think, through a lot of clouds, and then you see Santa Claus, like, he was just like, oh, ho, ho. And it's like, it was a very simple experience, but something just resonated with me. And immediately afterwards, I bought a Rift at home, couldn't stop playing, didn't know I had motion sickness, but I went through it anyways, like 3 hours into it. I was very dizzy afterwards, but the immersion that came with it, just, I was willing to look past everything, almost. And it really felt like a true calling for me. I always played games as a kid. I never really imagined myself actually becoming a game developer. I think it's still pretty surprising for me today. But I've always really enjoyed games. I find myself always to be quite technically savvy. And I truly like designing spaces. Like, for example, in high school, when I was still a high school student, I was trying to apply to art schools, I was drawing all these like abstract spatial compositions. I remember I had this interview with a professor in a UK art school. And I remember I was applying for a complete different major. And a guy was looking at my portfolio, he was like, you should do interior design because everything you make is about spatial composition and stuff. And I was completely surprised. My dad was an architect. I at first actually wanted to avoid this industry. But he was like, this is something clearly that you have a vision for. He's like, you should go for this. I was like, okay. Went into it. And I think Pratt was very, very helpful in that. One of the very valued skills that I really appreciate that I had gone through this journey, I think at Pratt, they teach you how to kind of think about space conceptually. It was in college where I kind of started learning the concept of phenomenology. And I think that actually really resonates with spatial experiences because that's basically architectural theory that invites designers and architects to think about the space as a procedural, as a, how do I explain it in a very simple way? As a way for users or dwellers to kind of go through an experience. So essentially, a space is not just for function, it's also for an experience. And a lot of times I think, for example, churches and a lot of religious structures kind of consider that because they want to bring you to that other dimension, to higher calling. And I think that really resonated with me in college, and that translated really well into VR. Because in VR, like, it's not just about building spaces. It's also about the holistic experience itself. But in college, I also realized, like, interior architecture, it's only about spaces. But if you really think about an XR experience, it's also about interaction as well. And I knew that games was the early beginning of that. So with that mindset, after working for a year or two, decided went to USC because I realized interaction is something I really want to pursue and kind of lean into. So that's where graduate school was really, really helpful. Was very fortunate to have mentors like Tracy Fullerton, Richard Lamartian, and a lot of USC professors who are really talented, really great professors, taught us a lot of principles on game design, prototyping. And I think through that, I just essentially honed my craft. The program wasn't about VR. It was actually purely about game design. And for example, I didn't even learn a single line of coding when I went in. But every time I do a project, I'm like, I have to do this in VR. So spent four times the effort as most of my cohorts, but in return, I think I also learned four times faster and just kept pushing and pushing. And thankfully, I earned an opportunity to kind of work on a thesis project at USC where essentially we get to recruit a team of students who are taking my thesis project as like their capstone requirements. So we got like 20 part-time students working together. We actually started working on a hand-tracking VR city building game at the time. It's very cool. It's actually still on a Rift store. I don't think a lot of people know about it. It's very hidden. But it was a very fun experience. That was the first time kind of we went through an 18-month production from top to bottom. School was very supportive about it. And I think more importantly is like the whole team kind of learned through the process by actually doing it, which is something really rare. And I think not a lot of students actually get to experience until they go into the industry. So it was a very great simulation for us. And I think it really helped us throughout this production after graduation too. Obviously, right now, our team is a lot smaller, just five people. But more importantly, I think we had the experience and pleasure of working together. We trust each other. And I really have to thank the team for that. They're a really talented bunch of designers, engineers, technical artists. And through that experience, it really helped build confidence that, hey, maybe we can create something interesting. And next thing you know, we're all surprised that we're here at South by Southwest.
Nice. And you also just released on the Quest Store on March 6th, right before South By. So congratulations on the public launch there as well. So we get a little bit of a recap of both the tendency towards looking at the interior design, and you'd mentioned around the moving from mixed reality to virtual reality and having more of that spatial context as a reward. And it's also a lot of interaction design and hand tracking that is in this piece. But I think also a core mechanic, I'd say, is also a part of the genre of VR is like a rhythm game. So like things like Beat Saber and other games where it's really based upon specific timed motions. In this case, it's more kind of a flowy freedom to move your hands in lots of different ways. But as long as you cross the intersection of this circle at a certain point, then you have your freedom to have a lot of other creative expression that isn't as constrained as some other rhythm games that I've seen. But there's also like this synesthetic experience that I get from this piece that's really fascinating. But maybe if we take a step back and hear some of the design inspiration from one of the most popular emerging genres of VR, especially VR gaming, is both the VR gaming and fitness genres. I'd love to hear any of your entry points into this broader ecosystem of rhythm games.
Yeah, of course. Now, obviously, the spatial concept, that's a very personal pursuit and passion of mine. And this is obviously teamwork. So my partner, Ethan, he is more in the interaction design arena. So I think he can also give a lot more input on this as well. But obviously, we work on this together, so we both share this journey. So for example, my partner, Ethan, he's actually a very enthused Beat Saber player. I think at one point during 2020, I think he was top US 150. I might be wrong, but he's really good. He's still really cracked in our game. I don't think anyone so far in our team can beat his score. And it's funny you brought that up earlier. So in the very beginning, we weren't even exactly sure that we were going to make a rhythm game. The core concept really came from conducting, synesthesia, kind of pairing the interaction with some sort of visual feedback. And we had two directions we wanted to go into, equally wanted to explore. The other direction, which we didn't go through, is actually that idea of a more creative version, where you have a lot more agencies, where you're, instead of being dictated on what to do, you have the freedom to kind of just wave around and you create these feedbacks. And I think that was an initial struggle in terms of the concept of us battling around. We chose a former because we think it's much more approachable for regular audiences. And we think that, you know, there's obviously already a very huge existing rhythm game fan base in the space already. Not to mention a lot of great games before us that we obviously learned a lot and took precedence in. Beat Saber is obviously the elephant in the room. Synth Rider. But there's a lot of great rhythm game titles before us. So when we decided to move into this direction, we were also quite careful on not exactly imitating it. So we made actually a whole range of wild prototypes. A lot of them did not work. A lot of them were interesting, but you know, there's a lot of give and take in there. One thing that we really focused on in the very beginning of development is just to let it flow. And I think that I learned a lot from for a whole team at USC, and for me personally, because I was trained as interior architect in art school, one thing they really advocate for is just iteration, iteration, iteration. So we have like 10, 20 very ugly, barely playable prototypes that are just exploring a whole wide range of concepts. In fact, I think the very first prototype for this version, we had two circles, one for each hand. It was quite cool, but then you realize like you have to look left and right at the same time, very hard to focus. We had a version where it's a podium in front of you, so notes are coming out through podium, but then we realized it's kind of a 2D flat surface, not very encouraging. I think the fundamental inspiration for this kind of radio mechanic really came from guiding players on certain directions and motions. We did face also a lot of challenges on setting exactly how big the ring is and providing a cue, because the design of it is very radio. So one of the things that a lot of other rhythm games do, of course, is that they utilize Z-Def Log.
Z-Def Log just mean your depth perception?
Yeah, well, actually, quite simply, just when notes are flying from far away from you towards you. So that's basically what Beat Saber is really, really excelled at. We realized that we really try to avoid that, and we just want to see if we can create another variation of ways you can anticipate these notes. And it proved to be quite a challenge, because it really relies on, and even right now for the final product, it does rely on you kind of noticing things peripherally. But also, at first we were also a little iffy about it. Then we realized this is actually quite an interesting mechanic to kind of encourage you, not necessarily to kind of rotate your neck around, but paying attention to the peripheral of what you can see. And that creates quite an interesting challenge that we think was worth exploring. So we kind of went through with it.
Yeah, it's almost like if you have a soft gaze and you're not specifically looking at anything in particular, then you can start to kind of notice things almost unconsciously, or you kind of start to notice the cues. Because you have, before it hits, you have it kind of as a hazy, diffuse color that then once it hits, it becomes solid. So you can start to get a sense of the timing. But yeah, they're coming in from the periphery, from both up, down, left, and right. And so you have to have that awareness of the timing and kind of see relative to each other. Sometimes you have to go in a specific order. So yeah, I found it's a very satisfying mechanic that works quite well. But yeah, I found if you have to soften your gaze, or at least the more that you do it, then the better you get at being able to perceive. It's like an extension of your normal perception.
Thank you. Yeah, we played a lot of like very tiny tricks to kind of guide you almost unconsciously. And through our playtest feedback, actually, the funny thing is sometimes players don't notice it at all. They won't directly describe what they saw. Like, they wouldn't say that they saw it. But you can tell the clear difference, like, before and after, whether they could anticipate the cues early or not. And that specific mechanic where it glows around the ring, I actually can't take credit for that. That came from AWE last year. Andrew from Alchemy Lab actually tried our prototype. We were very excited about that. And he actually gave us that tip. So I humbly took it. So I am not going to take credits for that. But yeah, and I think the other thing is we were quite aggressively on playtesting. We would grab everyone and anyone. And oftentimes I find it more useful to grab people who have never played before or never even entered VR before. You know, you can say like, yes, there is a existing base of VR audience that you should cater to. But I think even till this day, this medium has not gone fully mainstream yet. I think for any title, it's still quite important to onboard new players to kind of outreach and expand the base. So for me, that's something for both me and Ethan, our team together, we're very obsessed about this. So playtesting really helps. Gets quite frustrating. Sometimes I'll scratch my head and be like, oh no. But you know, in the end of the day, I think sometimes these failed playtests actually bring so much more feedback and improvement to the development process. And that's something I take very, very seriously.
Well, you're launching with three separate tiers of difficulty, which I think is also an interesting challenge, because you are able to do the game progression curve where you're starting off with the simple and then moving into medium and then moving into hard. And there's a similar mechanic where in Beat Saber, if you miss too many notes in a row, then it stops and you have to do it again. I was able to always get through the beginner, no problem, never failed. The medium, failed maybe a couple of times, but for the most part, I was able to get through, but that was just because I could restock up my capacity to get through a scene. And then in hard, when I first tried it, it was like, okay, there's no way. This is like, I'm failing so quickly. I'm going to have to like work my way up to it. So there's this, right out of the bat, this sense of like, okay, there's a certain, it's easy to pick up, easy to learn, but it's one of those broad games where you could get better and better, at least that you're starting right off there for the hardcore gaming crowd to have a challenge to kind of work up to. And so with those different skill levels, there's also on top of that, the scoring system, which I know that that's been a key innovation in something like Beat Saber, where there's a lot of subtle, like the more that you can perceive the objects further, that means you can get prepared and have like a larger swipe, which has a score differential that is able to differentiate skills and levels of play, maybe different tiers of ability, but specifically you're able to really dial it in. So when you're looking at a game like this, you have both the core mechanic of maybe just people want to get in a flow state, they don't really even care about the score, but then the scoring on top of that is also there to allow some incentive for people to continue to improve and to track their own improvement, but also to potentially compete with each other. So love to hear about both the different tiers of difficulty as well as the scoring system and how those co-evolved as you were developing the game.
Yeah, I can talk a lot about these two, actually. So in terms of difficulty, it's pretty funny. I think as a developer, you get very biased. So I would say most of our team is pretty good. So, and I think that happens with any rhythm game developers. You lean on creating much harder maps than you can design. We have around half of them, which have a much harder map that I don't think most people can play. Actually, some of them I don't think I can even beat. And this is...
So it's like an extra hard that you have that hasn't been released?
Yes. We're internally calling it expert mode, and we're debating on when we're going to release it, depending on whether we're seeing a lot of hardcore players, hard difficulties. If they want a challenge, we do have something hopefully in store in the future. But it's funny, like, I think if we're talking about difficulty, I have to also mention about designing maps for these classical tracks as well. It's actually quite a challenge for classical orchestra. Because one thing that contemporary music has is a very constant BPM. So things are very easy to kind of time. But for a classical orchestra, the BPM constantly shifts because in the end of the day, they're actually being conducted by a real conductor. It's a human directing the metronome, the beats. So they fluctuate. And sometimes for expressive reasons too. Like a song can have a very fast BPM during certain sessions, but when things start quieting down, they'll really slow down. And it works really, really well for the composition. Technically, it doesn't go in favor with rhythm games. And that was part of the challenge. The other part, I think, for us, the difficulty really comes from your anticipation from different cues. And I think through a lot of trial and errors, we also realized that patterns are quite important for us as well. Because if you want to encourage hard maps with higher density, frequency of notes, as a designer, you kind of need to predict on where their arms are going to move. And sometimes if you do it in a very, let's say, a not great pattern, like you'll find yourself constantly like colliding with your hands a lot. These prove to be quite a challenge. And then the other side of me, I think this is something that our team kind of, like, I'm not saying actually fight, but like argues about, is like there's one camp, which is me and one person on our team, who prefers to make it more like a conducting pattern where 4-4 is down, left, right, up. Like waltz is a down, right, up, for example. But if you keep doing that, that also gets quite repetitive. And then there's the other side of the team where it's like we should make it a really fun game. And when you make a game, you break a lot of rules of conducting for good reasons. And we sure do break a lot. Like, for example, real life conductor, right hand is tempo, left hand is expression. But whereas in our game, like, you're actually constantly switching that as well. So by no means are we a conducting simulator. I think it truly is an inspiration from conducting. I think the holistic experience matters more for us, and that's what's unique. But through that, that's a lot of iterations that we just keep, again, like playtesting to kind of discover. And for example, the original hard maps were way too hard, so we kind of tone it down. And through a lot of playtest videos that we observe, we kind of map it out. I think one thing we did right was introducing that difficulty scale on the right side of the song panel so you get a sense, because not every medium song has the equal amount of difficulty. In fact, we slowly kind of ramp it up as you kind of go later. So some easy songs, technically you can mark it as medium, but if you went through enough repetition, so to speak, your skill level also improves. So that was a fine balance that we have to take. And it's funny, hardcore players find easy too easy. But if you find someone who is very new to VR, I think easy is actually a perfect level for them. And medium, we're really just trying to kind of position it between the two. And yeah, if anyone wants a challenge, we do have harder maps available.
And can you elaborate a little bit more on terms of how are you determine the score? Because I know that in say Beat Saber, hitting it like in the center, but also like the more further away and the depth of speed, sometimes speed, I don't know, it's kind of like a secret algorithm a lot of times these rhythm games will have in terms of how the score is actually working. But in terms of the bottom line, it seems like the more that you anticipate, there can be other more exaggerated motions. So in some ways, the score is reflecting of how well you're able to do this situational awareness of being able to perceive and anticipate the beats before they reach the final destination. That seems to be what the scoring has been based upon before. So as you were looking at that as an existing conceit, if you were trying to mimic that or if you had any other twists for that.
So yeah, in the very beginning, our scoring mechanic was much more complex. Actually, we had two elements, both your accuracy and timing and your accuracy and direction. So we wanted to give players like the perfect score if they hit exactly in the middle of the ring at the perfect time. It turns out to be quite a difficulty. I think we're also facing the challenge because we're a game that supports both hand tracking and controllers. We have to consider the affordances of what hand tracking can bring. Now, we worked with hand tracking for 3-4 years now, and it's leaps and bounds of improvements. I'm hoping to see more from Meta soon. But there is still latency, there's still inaccuracy, and sometimes depending on the player's like environment, whether they're well lit enough, that really impacts the accuracy of tracking them. So we made the hard choice of simplifying it a lot. So in the very beginning, that's something, of course, Ethan is very into Beat Saber, so this is something he really wanted to kind of absorb and take in. But we realized because we have the limitations of hand tracking, we kind of kept it simple. It's really just about timing for now. But one thing I'll say is something that it's not in the game, hopefully someday that we'll get to introduce and incorporate, is the idea of special abilities that can boost your scores throughout the mechanic. By nature, in this game, you're wielding a magical wand. And I think wand itself wouldn't be necessarily called a wand if there's a special ability. And going back to the very beginning when I was talking about the version between creative and more of a rhythm game, one thing we kind of want to snatch from the first version was the concept that these wands also have special abilities depending on how you perform them. So we can further encourage different types of expression. The examples I like to bring is like a wand that gives you extra score if you hit it really hard. And that might be a very difficult wand to use for a fairy dream song that's like morning moon, whereas everything's like very light. Whereas the other one's probably the polar opposite, and then you'll find it extra challenging if you're doing Fate Symphony and just trying to like gently tap on things without making big movements to multiply your scores. But these are something I think it takes a lot more iterations and playtesting to figure out, because that comes a lot of gameplay balancing is something we need to consider, and definitely something we are very interested in bringing up in the future.
Yeah, and I played both with the hand tracking and the controllers, and when I was playing with just my hands, I felt it was extremely magical of a feeling. I had a conversation with the developers of Thrasher, and that's basically like a ribbon game where you have like a stick and you have like this, you can think of it as a ribbon that is a snake that's kind of falling around. And so, you know, the way they described it is that it's almost like, or maybe it was Doug Northcook who was describing it as like this extension of my proprioceptive perception, where I can feel my body and that I see the reaction of my movements as an extension out into this virtual space. And so there's like this laser pointer that's coming from my hands. And so it gives me the experience of my body being extended into this virtual space. And when I'm holding a controller, somehow that same type of illusion is broken, because then I'm associating that laser with the object that I'm holding. It's no longer a part of my body. It's a part of this tool that I'm holding. Because when I'm holding something in my hand, there's something in my brain that translates whatever is coming out of that as more reasonable coming from that tool than my body. So there's that difference. But then another difference is that when I have the hand track controllers, I get haptic feedback, which is another signal that can help to subtly train me to kind of have better movements. There's also, like you said, like the latency difference, but I found like a precision thing that there's sometimes where you have the user like cross over their hands. And I found that when I was crossing my hands over, like it was losing my hand tracking on one of the hands and then not hitting it. And so the hand tracking was impeding what I thought would have normally been, like I did the proper motion, but it was just like a limitation of the computer vision. Maybe my lighting in my room was too dark. I was playing in the middle of the night before I came out to South by Southwest. And so it felt like I could have a more precise experience with the controller, which is very similar to what my experience to Thrasher was, which was that it was more of a visceral, satisfying feeling with the hands, but I could get like a better technical score with the controller, and it had haptics that were also good that I was missing. So it seems like there's these two different trade-offs where they're both compelling as an experience, but there's just different affordances for each of those. So just love to hear some of your thoughts on that.
I think you're actually quite spot on this. I wholeheartedly agree. And it's interesting because also it depends on the audience on what they prefer. I think for a lot of existing VR game players, they're not a fan of hand tracking at all. They much prefer to have the haptic feedback, the slightly bigger latency, so to speak. And for rhythm game, it actually does matter a lot in terms of latency because you want to hit things on time. But if you're a casual player, someone who's like mixed reality curious, just got your 3 or 3S, I think hand tracking is quite magical, and it's worth the trade-off sometimes for the lack of precision, especially if you're dealing with an easy map where it's really more just about the experience of that synesthetic magical journey, so to speak. So I think it also depends on the player. But if it goes my way, I wish that we have a haptic-based wristband that allows you to track your hands. No latency, you can even put your hands behind your back. And then every time you wave, you get a vibration. Hopefully someday, sometime in the future, that will come. But right now, yes, we are dealing with two different scenarios where... But I do see in the future that the benefits of both can kind of merge together. And I think that's when hand tracking titles will truly, truly make a lot more sense. For certain games, of course, because some games is really better for a controller. But in our experience specifically, yeah, I'm just daydreaming here.
No, it's great. Yeah, I know Meta has the Control Labs wristband that they have also for neural inputs. But yeah, having like the haptics come for your wrist is really quite interesting. And so when I was talking to Blake Kamendiener leading up to the festival, he said that when he's playing Symphony, he ended up playing for like an hour, and it was like a time when he was really needing to watch other experiences, but he just got so into it. And I had a similar experience in the sense that I wanted to get a sense of the game, but knowing that I heard that from Blake, I was like, okay, what was it that he was really tapping into? And I think it was the fact that the way that you have both the achievements that are there, but also more than anything, I think it was having these other realms that are being unlocked with the potential of new songs that are there. And so I played through the point where I wanted to unlock each of the four levels that you're launching with so that I could see the range of different songs and everything. And also it was kind of a progression up to like from medium up to hard. And then I was like, okay, my goal within this first hour of play is like, can I beat one of the hard levels? And I ended up getting through one of them. I think it was on the third or fourth level, but there's a very satisfying game design and the usual incentives where you're not revealing everything, but there's these different achievements and milestones. And I think it also helps for people, like a whole wall of different achievements that you can get. Some of them are explicit, some of them you kind of get and you only know about them once you get them. But you have other kind of game design-y type of things in order to encourage people to continue to play. I mean, I think the game is satisfying within its own right, but it also helps to have these other achievements to go, which I can testify that it had me play longer than I probably would have after I got the sense of it, because I wanted to reach these different milestones. So I'd love to hear some of your reflections on onboarding people into this game, but also having these other achievements and journey that you're taking people on through the unlocking of stuff, but also the spatial journeys that you want to take people on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very flattered to hear that. I was quite surprised. Blake told me that yesterday as well. I was quite flattered and surprised. I'm glad that some of our mechanics are working out. We did intentionally design them to be quite minimal. And I think, you know, the achievement and the progression, that really came from understanding that there's different archetypes of gamers. It was quite a bold move, honestly, for a rhythm game to not unlock everything. But the reason why we wanted to do this progression system actually really came back from the idea of really highlighting these different types of synesthetic experiences. In the very beginning, we actually opened up to everything. We realized that just made individual ones a little less special, Whereas if you kind of slowly unlock them one by one, it further reinforces the idea that you're earning the next kind of round. And it makes it a much more progressive journey where you get to actually appreciate individual ones a little more. And it's funny because you'll find players have different preferences of different types of realms too. So that might be a nice kind of objective for players to achieve that helps with the process too. So when you finish a song, you get that instant gratification that, you know, you performed well, you performed okay, or you performed great. But right after that, you also get to progress on something that's a little grander. And achievement is interesting. Through our playtests, if you're not like a collector, you won't necessarily pay attention to. But for some collectors, you know, sometimes it's not even about the score. It's really about like whether that locked icon just scratches their brain. And they're just like, I absolutely have to get them. And we think that's also a pretty nice challenge. That's something we can kind of also expand upon. But we are a very, very small studio. You know, obviously, we kept the scope quite contained, but we were quite careful about what we're introducing, and we're trying to keep it minimal so people can go on and keep going. In the end of the day, we still brand our genre as kind of arcade. And speaking about that, that's why I'm also very pleasantly surprised to be at South by Southwest. I've watched a lot of the other XR works this year, and they're all truly amazing, and honestly brought me back to that initial sense of wonder and joy when I first tried Riff. And we honestly are very pleasantly surprised to be here as like this very little kind of arcade rhythm game here.
Yeah, well, it is a music, film, and technology festival. So I think traditionally South by Southwest has had a number of different music-related experiences. So I think Blake in particular is really paying attention to bring more of those. So I think it fits certainly in that context. And I have a little funny anecdote, which is that the first time I played one of the hard scenes, for some reason, I had picked up the controllers and I had put them down, but then the tracking was still on the controllers and not picking up my hands. And by the time it picked up, it was game over. And so I got the award of not able to slice any of the objects. So anyway, it was kind of a funny like wall of shame type of moment that now I'm going to be seeing forever when I open up the game. So
yeah, we were being quite sarcastic with some of the achievements, to be honest. There's one that everyone gets unlocked. I think it's Mom Get the Camera. You unlock the achievement by playing through the tutorial. Just thought out these were little fun anecdotes you get to try in the game.
Yeah, yeah. It's fun to have extra levels to kind of go and try to achieve. But I think the other distinct character of this game is the music. And just I was surprised how good it sounds and how good the performances are and the range of different songs. Can you elaborate a little bit on the process of actually curating the different songs that you wanted to feature, and also if you had a specific archive that you're going for, public domain stuff, or if you were contracting out orchestras, or what was the process of like getting these songs?
Well, obviously, since it was conducting inspired, I think that was the main intention, that if we're making something that's conducting related, not necessarily a conductor simulation, but just to really kind of hone in on that inspiration. That's why we're focusing a lot on classical music. And I think in sort of curation, so this is also another funny thing about the process of designing it. In the very beginning, before we kind of went into the actual prototype of seeing these visual transitions, we didn't know how magical it is ourselves either. So in the very beginning, it was really just synesthesia. It was Kandinsky-inspired abstract visuals. That's actually what the original vision was for. And what we wanted to do was actually map different albums with wheels of emotions. So you have, like, for example, Rage, that's like Fate Symphony. You have Surprise, that's Four Seasons. Joy, that's like Morning Mood, for example. And then we realized these are just, they're almost too abstract and sometimes even underwhelms the visual sequences that we designed. And more importantly is like when we went through a whole song with these reactive visuals, we realized it really felt magical for us too. Like I had that moment where I was like, wow, like this might be something different. And I was like, why don't we double down on that, really go into this. So we kind of redesign our visuals a little bit, match it more with these magical thematics that I think is also much more approachable for players to get and a more entertaining experience. So that's why we kind of branded into, you know, for example, Fairy Dream, Dark Magic, Crimson Curse, Radiant Charm. And the song choices are, we actually bought more licenses than we currently have because we were picking and choosing. We wanted songs that have a stronger tempo, especially when they're fast. So it's easier to kind of create challenging maps. We also wanted a range of things that are more peaceful and quiet, so if you just kind of want this casual experience, you can. Now, that also doesn't make the hard less challenging either, which was very interesting for us to kind of discover as we went along as well. And the last part would be, you know, we also wanted to pick songs that most people are associated with, like Hungarian Dance, Symphony 40. Now, a lot of people might not necessarily know the name of it, but once they hear the tune, they're like, oh, yeah, I know this song from somewhere. The least known song is probably Mars Bringer of War, but fun history fact, I guess, I think that track inspired Star Wars soundtrack, actually. So there's a little resemblance there. That's why we picked it. So yeah, I think it's a collection of that. And obviously, we are a very, very small and young studio. So I think doing classical music does help us. And we hope that we get to show people this experience, how we envision how you can get to interact music. And hopefully, this will be the first of many for us.
Yeah, there's another conducting-based hand-tracking game that's come out recently called Maestro. I haven't had a chance to play it yet, but have you had a chance to play it? And how do you compare it to what you're doing?
I think it's a wonderful game. I also do think that we're tackling a similar concept with a totally different direction. And by all means, I think they did a fantastic job of bringing you actually in front of an orchestra in this very French theater. You know, if you perform badly, like you'll see like banana or apple getting thrown at you. It's a wonderful game. I love the experience. Always have a lot of respect for the team and a big fan. But for us, it's really more about the aspect of teleporting you into these more fantastical realms. So it's much more abstract and I would say fantastical. It's definitely not a simulation. You don't get an orchestra in front of you. We are trying really hard instead to kind of elevate the baton into an actual wand, which is something I think, you know, both of us have our strengths and things that, you know, you don't get in the other game. So yeah, I'm also a big fan of Maestro as well.
Yeah, because in your game you have each level you start off, you are in a mixed reality context, and then as you get further and further in the game, then you get more and more into the virtual world. And if you start to miss some notes, then that virtual reality will start to shrink back into, in this kind of portal-like fashion where it goes back into the mixed reality. But also the sound gets muffled in a way that it's like a low-pass filter that is only hearing the lower frequencies. So when you are not performing as well, you actually hear a worse version of the music, which also is another incentive to play better because you don't want to hear a modulation of the music that's coming through. So love to hear around both the design indicating that you are missing notes or getting close to potentially being failing, and then also the slow reveal into the virtual realms.
So for fail state, I think that was something quite interesting for us to discover too. And we actually debated about whether we should introduce fail state. In the very beginning, we kind of let players kind of go through the whole song. But we realized it was also quite defeating, actually, if you just let them go through it when they're not doing super well, because the score just have a giant F in front of your face. I don't think anyone likes to be reminded for, like, you know, it's fine if it's just, like, 1 minute, you know. It's like, ah, like, I didn't do it right. And then in me, it's like, oh, sorry, like, you failed. But if you get, like, 3 straight minutes of F in front of your face and you're just trying really hard but you're still missing because it's like out of your skill set, difficulty level, not skill set, then yeah, it's not particularly fun. So I think that was something we were like, okay, maybe we should still introduce fail state. We do hope that in the future we can even kind of bring up more elements of fail state as well. I think a couple players and playtesters actually mentioned this. So hopefully we can also add some visual cues and indications down the line to kind of indicate whether you're actually failing or not. But we did play some very simple tricks to kind of indicate whether you are going well or not. And just to gently remind you, like, hey, like, you're almost about to end the song involuntarily. You want to try a little harder. But yeah, it's a quite simple mechanic, but quite powerful, and I think really helps the gameplay loop because, again, like, it's not fun if you see an F for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. There's also a couple of core mechanics in the easier modes. One is just the slicing at the right time, and the other is that you have to put your hand or your laser pointer from your hand in a spot for that static, and then sometimes those spots move. And then sometimes, you know, at the end of the song, there's this I don't know what it's called in conducting, but you're basically like asking people to hold and you see the conductor like shaking their hands, you know? So I was kind of doing that at certain parts of the song. It was really well timed. And sometimes those other types of motions were, I didn't see any other connection to the music that was being played other than, okay, this is more of a higher challenge to be able to put my other hand in this location where there's a primary and secondary hand in that case, where I think you actually have like handedness, like are you left or right handed? So maybe determining these primary versus secondary functions. But I'm wondering if you could elaborate on both the slicing mechanic, but also this tracking and all the different things that you were thinking about in terms of having a little bit of variety. So it wasn't just a slicing game, but you wanted to also add different skills. Because in the hard level, you actually have to go for a split second to put your hand in a very specific spot before you start to slice. So in other levels, you combine those two mechanics where you have to go to a specific spot before you can slice it. So it creates this kind of whipping effect. But yeah, I'd love to hear you elaborate a little bit more on those core mechanics of the game.
Yeah, so this is interesting because that really came from the inspiration of conducting. Like I mentioned earlier, which is something actually Maestro also does, the game, which is right hand temple, left hand is expression, right? You would rise your left hand, lower your left hand, point at certain part of the orchestra to kind of dictate how the expression and, you know, dramatic moments in a piece. So in the very beginning, we were also trying to mimic that and through different types of expression and UX as well. So we knew from the very beginning that for tempo, for us, I think the directionality matters a lot. But we also kind of want to give a very concrete feedback, which is how the ring and the arc kind of came to be. In the very beginning, we actually only did it for the left hand, where you're kind of just rising smiling, and the right hand was only hitting these arcs. And it's interesting because in the very beginning, actually, those bubbles that you kind of point at or kind of glide towards, they were actually very close to you. We actually made it very 3D, where you have to physically put your hand into it and then kind of start rising it. It actually feels very, very powerful. I was quite sad that we had to let that go. But one of the challenges we learned from there, which is quite funny, is Z-Def. We found that a lot of players, like, it's already quite challenging when they're kind of checking the peripheral. And when we added that element, it was like, okay, so you have to look closely to your orb in front of you, put your hand into it, while there's something going behind and you have to do your right hand. We realized that hand-eye coordination was too much. It's doable, it's just too much of a learning curve that we realized that it's probably not the best. So we just found ourselves keep pushing and pushing and pushing the orb back. We try something that's a little more abstract too, where instead of actually like pointing at a bubble, we'll check whether your hand is moving that direction to give you an indication. But that was also too much information almost. So I think it's funny because in the very beginning of our development, we actually were quite maximalist. And I meant like literally everything from the mechanic to the feedback to the environment. And then we just kept reduce, reduce, reduce. Because we think minimalism here actually plays a huge factor. Not that we want to give like the least viable experience. Rather, I think the minimalism from everything here is to actually highlight and accentuate the things that we are doing well, so that the experience feels very coherent and actually more immersive. So that's how the point mechanic came to be. And then slowly, because like we said before, we are still trying to make a game. Well, actually for us, we don't even necessarily call it a game. We think about it as a play, right? Like what makes it the most playful experience. So that's where we really kind of deviate from conducting. Since you're wielding a wand, we thought, why don't we break a little rules on conducting? So that's where in hard difficulty, we're just playing with different patterns. And I think one of the designers was like, this is cool if you just point in the opposite direction, then incur some size down. We're like, why not? It's a mechanic there. Why don't we take advantage of it? Yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe when you bring out the expert mode, you can add in the near field orb that has Z-Def differences that you can add that extra layer of difficulty for folks. So, yeah.
that would be really fun. I feel like we're going to get as many folks excited as many folks frustrated.
Well, maybe you could talk a bit about the virtual world architectural interior designs that you did for each of the different levels and just kind of make some comments on your process of coming from the background of architecture. This is an opportunity to do some of this larger spatial design that may be amplifying other aspects of this overall experience. So love to hear just some comments on that.
I think if we're talking about this specific piece, we actually went through a lot of iterations. in the very beginning, because the team was very small and our budget was even lower, I was trying to be quite economical. I'm not ashamed to admit that. We also try like using like AI skyboxes. And like I said before, it was like more abstract themes. One thing I was kept is actually kind of how the space transitions. That was the only remaining part. Realized that didn't work. We move on to kind of magical themes. And we still went a little abstract. So it was more like Kandinsky. It was like more geometric. It was outlined. It was a very architecture vision of magic, which also didn't work out really well. Then we took a step back. I was like, okay, what do we need to do to actually present these themes and the mood of it? So we took a lot of inspirations from existing films, and I think that's when things started to click a little bit. And it's interesting for this one because it's actually quite challenging to design the transition between reality and virtual, mainly because you don't know what the real space is. Everyone has a different space. We're right now at a room where the ceiling's around 12 feet or taller. For most American households, it's 7 feet. They might just be playing the bathroom, and I wouldn't even know. So I think that was the particular challenge for us, is to consider these unknown factors. So that's why intentionally for these, we design a lot of soft spaces. For certain ones, we did, especially when the songs are intense, like Dark Magic, it's intentional. Sometimes it's very intentional deep space. So you feel that kind of drastic movement. For Fairy Dream, when the mood is getting very light, that's relatively soft. The other thing we play a lot here is actually color. And I think color, although subjective, I think when you pair with music, especially classical music, which is super expressive, I think that bodes really well in accentuating the mood. And, you know, you were saying earlier, like, the song selections are great. Well, obviously, they're made by, like, you know, geniuses from the ages. But not only that, I think just having that audiovisual synchronization really, really helps here. And I think it's a combination of both that really highlighted experience. And it's funny because for a rhythm game, sometimes the visuals is not the first thing you notice. We still thought it was worth the effort because even if it's not your primary attention, whatever is happening in the background, this reinforces on your holistic experience. And I think that's where sometimes you have to take a step back and just kind of enjoy the piece as a whole. And I think that's where this thing really shines.
Yeah, there's a really nice building and releasing of tension through the mechanics, where you have single-handed mechanics and then two-handed mechanics, and you're able to use those as the music is also having points of release of tension. And so when you have this release of tension with both your hands, it's just really quite satisfying. So really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and another thing, I'm particularly obsessed with transitions. And I think this actually came from, I think, a paper in 1994. I found that actually in, I know Microsoft doesn't do mixed reality anymore, but if you look up what is mixed reality on Microsoft documentation, they actually do a very perfect explanation of what mixed reality is. I know Meta likes to say VR, MR are the same thing now.
They're on MR now, yeah.
Yeah. Like, mixed reality is actually quite an old term. And one thing to note from like the earlier definition is that it's actually a spectrum.
So Cuccino paper back in 99 or something.
Yes, exactly. So he argues that for these experiences, it can be either fully virtual or fully real. And then it's very fluid in the middle, even for cell phones, phone AR. And one can argue actually in some ways that VR itself is actually mixed reality, because you're not fully embodying yourself into another reality. Your smell, your haptics, your touch, actually, these still are grounded. It's only like your audiovisual and proprioception that's getting replaced. And I find that particularly fascinating because, for me, why can't one experience go through this whole spectrum? And that's why I mentioned very early on, I'm very intrigued by this contrast. And to me, there's a lot of things you can play with it as well. But it's very hard, I think, for a lot of VR games to transition into MR like this. I think part of the reason why we were able to do this is because in the very beginning, I was even before Quest 3 came out, we were doing this on Quest Pro. We were like, mixed reality is going to be a bigger thing. It's going to be more approachable for everyone. Let's design an experience that truly utilizes this and make it a lot more dynamic so we can offer something quite unique, especially if you're trying out Color Pass-Through for the first time.
Great. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of virtual reality and these types of immersive and interactive games might be? And what they might be able to enable.
I think there's a lot of exciting futures with XR. I'm personally quite, as you can tell from my earlier story, I'm truly obsessed by it. I do think that as form factors become more and more approachable to the mass public, I do believe that how we perceive the world is going to fundamentally change because of this overlay of digital information. For me, it is both very exciting and also terrifying almost sometimes what it can bring. But I hope that throughout this journey, I've met a lot of talented developers, enthusiasts, and I think everyone here wants to build something that truly kind of help improve the world. For me, I'm particularly interested in how music can change. The way we experience music can evolve and change as more and more people adopt this medium. If you look at how radio, the internet, you know, TV with music videos, how like new technologies always kind of fundamentally revolutionize or introduce a new way of experiencing music, I do believe that is going to come as more and more people kind of adopt this device. And that is something for now I'm particularly interested in. There's obviously going to be a new wave of storytelling. I mean, some of the pieces that I've saw here at South by Southwest is truly mesmerizing, and things have changed a lot since, you know, the early Rift days on how people design, how people think about the shots. And I think there's a lot of exciting futures ahead.
Awesome. And is there anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
No, I'm a newcomer to this space though, so excited to be here. Very flattered to be in this interview. And hopefully it will be the first of many for our new studio, and looking forward to see what kind of future we forge together with XR.
Awesome. Well, Ingram, thanks so much for joining me here on the podcast, and really encourage all my listeners to go check out Symphony, especially if you're a fan of rhythm games or a fan of the game Thrasher or any kind of like hand-tracked games. I think it's a really beautiful melding of mixed reality, rhythm games. Love the music, love the mechanics, and yeah, look forward to continuing to progress up and to be able to at least complete all of the initial 16 songs on hard mode that you've released. And it looks like you're going to be, you know, continuing to release more songs over time. But yeah, really enjoyed playing the game so far and look forward to diving more deeply into it here in the future. So thanks again here for joining me here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Thank you. And I hope to see you in the leaderboards.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast. And there is a lot that's happening in the world today, and the one place that I find solace is in stories, whether that's a great movie, a documentary, or immersive storytelling. And I love going to these different conferences and festivals and seeing all the different work and talking to all the different artists and sharing that with the community, because I think there's just so much to be learned from listening to someone's process, to hear about what they want to tell a story about. And even if you don't have a chance to see it, just to have the opportunity to hear about a project that you might have missed or to learn about it. And so this is a part of my own creative process of capturing these stories and sharing it with a larger community. And if you find that valuable and want to sustain this oral history project that I've been doing for the last decade, then please do consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Every amount does indeed help sustain the work that I'm doing here, even if it's just $5 a month. That goes a long way for allowing me to continue to make these trips and to ensure that I can see as much of the work as I can and to talk to as many of the artists as I can and to share that with the larger community. So you can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.